What's up, ODs and eyewear lovers? We're talking the latest trends in tech and eye care, so sit back, relax, and defocus.
Greetings, esteemed colleagues, and welcome to the Defocus Media Podcast. My name is Daryl Glover, and along with me is the lovely Jennifer Lyerly. And today we have a very special guest. We actually have a hometown favorite and specialist when it comes to refractive surgery. Friends and family, I'd like to welcome Dr. Michael Marino. Dr. Marino, thank you for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Now, before we get started, I have a very important question. Are you related to the NFL legend, Dan Marino?
I am not. We have the same spelling of the last name, but indeed no relation. He's from the Pittsburgh side of Pennsylvania. I'm from the Philadelphia side of Pennsylvania, so there is no relation there.
So tell us a little bit about your background and the type of practice you've been working in.
Sure. I graduated from Newenco back in 1998, and my first job was working out in rural North Carolina, out in Kenansville, North Carolina. From there, I've basically been working kind of most time in suburban practice and rural practice. And in the mid to late 2000s, I started working for TLC Laser Eye Centers. And I had met Dr. Stonecipher a long time ago because I practiced in a practice near him where he practices, and he is just an excellent surgeon, and he's honestly taught me everything I know about refractive surgery. I worked in a referral center for about 5 years, and I really learned a lot about basically the things you should and shouldn't do and think about from when you're referring to a doctor. And it's really the only I've never worked in another type of referral center, even though I did work at UNC for a little while as well. But again, that wasn't really a referral center. So hopefully we can talk about tonight things that ODs can look for when they're looking and or people are asking about refractive surgery to just make themselves look like more of an expert in it. Because if they're not going to hear it from you, they're going to hear it on the internet, which is probably most likely going to be wrong.
You know, I'm very excited that you're on the podcast today simply because, you know, when I came out of school, the one thing that I always struggled with was dealing with refractive surgery because I didn't really have a rotation to cater to that. So I'm very interested in knowing what advice do you have for new grads coming out of school in regards to talking to their patients on the options of refractive surgeries?
Sure. I think the best thing you could probably do, and it's something I wish I had done earlier in my career, was just call a refractive surgeon in your area, maybe ask around and see who's one who co-manages, probably the friendliest, for lack of a better term, for it. Just see if you can take them out to lunch. You know, and from there, just ask questions, you know, ask what kind of equipment he uses and why. If you ask why, that will kind of give you the idea of things that you can talk about with your patients to guide them in the right direction to choose a proper surgery. If you have time, I know it can be hard, especially when you're first out of school and needing to work as much as possible. See if you can take a day and observe a consult day at the refractive surgery center. From one day of watching 8 to 10 consults, you could learn more than you'd one ever learn in school, or two, learning from just trial and error from referring your own patients.
So this is an interesting concept. I mean, when you first start talking with patients about refractive surgery, I always never really brought it up unless a patient brought it up to me, like, what about LASIK in the exam room? What is your mindset as an optometrist now not working at a referral center? Do you wait for patients to talk to you about wanting refractive surgery, or do you start talking to them first?
I usually talk to them first. Most patients, unless they just come out and say it in their chief complaint that, you know, I'm looking to have surgery. Most patients have always been at least curious about it because now it's been around for so long in the mainstream that people will know someone who's had it done. Almost everyone knows someone who's had it done. So they're always thinking about it, you know. But one thing is, as you both know, everyone always thinks they have the worst vision, whether they're a -2 or a -10 or a -4. They think their vision's too bad.
Even a -0.25.
Exactly. Yeah. So, exactly. I mean, you know, everyone thinks their vision's awful. You know, so basically anyone who's between 25 and 40, after I do the refraction, if they're stable, even if they're a contact lens patient, they weren't asking, I just kind of, as I'm pulling the phoropter away, I'm like, you ever think about having refractive surgery? And, you know, probably 9 times out of 10, they're like, no, or well, I thought about it. But that 1 time out of 10, it kind of tickles something. And then they just at least get talking about it. And then if they're a glasses only wearer, and they're not into refractive surgery, sometimes in talking about that, it can even lead to a new contact lens fit or something like that, or even just a discussion of talking about new technologies or, you know, or something like that. So, but yeah, I always ask. Worst that happens is they have no interest. Boom, it took 5 seconds and it's done.
Just as a general prescription range, what patients are you considering now a pretty good LASIK referral?
Generally, pretty much a slam dunk is -1 to -6. Those are people that I actively will bring it up, you know, with really any amount of astigmatism under about -4. Those patients, you can pretty much tell the surgery is, it's going to be less and less likely that they're going to have too thin of a cornea to be able to be done. Okay. When you start getting over -7, then you start getting into the point of, well, you could tell them about LASIK, but you kind of have to throw in PRK, but then you can't use PRK if they're over -7. I mean, so there becomes a lot of variables and the conversation becomes more complicated. If you get above -9, you can still do LASIK from -9 to -12 technically, but most surgeons that I know or that I've talked to, that's when the ICL conversation starts coming into play. So in a general way, -1 to -6 is pretty easy. Anything under -1, you really have to have that conversation about, you know, being able to just take your glasses off when you get older and read. Those people generally get very, very disappointed. In plus, it's honestly a crapshoot. Only if someone's really, really motivated to have it done, and definitely if they're under +250.
Thank you for those parameters, Dr. Marino. I want to move backwards just a little bit. We have a lot of followers that are new graduates from optometry school, and I'd love for you to break down the difference between LASIK and PRK. Just a good background and history of the two procedures.
Sure. PRK was basically first, the first laser procedure, not including RK, which was from back in the 80s. PRK was first done in the U.S. from I think it was about 1980 or 1989. And it's basically the core of PRK and LASIK are the same. You're reshaping the cornea using a laser. In PRK, you don't create a flap of tissue. So you're basically just scraping away the top layer of the epithelium, and from there, reshaping the cornea. In 1994, LASIK was first done mainstream. The FDA clinical trial started in 1991. But since about 94 or 95, LASIK has been pretty much the go-to procedure simply because of healing time. Also, PRK, you know, has a little bit higher risk of causing scarring and just a little higher risk of enhancement and that kind of thing. So that's why generally we push people a little bit more towards LASIK. PRK, though, is still done on about 10 to 15% of first-time patients, on patients who have a slightly irregular cornea or a slightly thinner than average cornea. But the advances have come more with LASIK since starting about 2000. In 2000 to 2002 is when custom LASIK was first available. In 2005, and that's when really astigmatism started to be able to be treated in a very realistic way. In 2005 was when the microkeratome started to be phased out and you started using intralase, you know, bladeless LASIK, basically. And since then, there have been two or three different iterations of bladeless LASIK. The newest, latest and greatest tech over the last 2 years is what's called TCAT, which is a topographical guided LASIK or PRK that can actually treat pretty significant amounts of irregularity in a cornea as long as the cornea is not too thin or ectatic. So, you know, it's really, and what I always tell patients who ask me, well, what if I wait and I do surgery, you know, 2 years from now, is it going to be better? In general, all of the iterations of the leaps in technology have simply expanded the amount of people that can be done. You know, so first, it was myopes. Second, myopic astigmats. Then, hyperopic astigmats. Then, thinner corneas. Now, irregular corneas. So that you know, whereas if you're a -2 myope, you could have surgery, you know, tech from 2005 and your results will probably be just as good as if you had, you know, surgery yesterday.
So when you're talking irregular corneas, I mean, not specifically like keratoconus, or what type of irregularities would be safe to do a refractive surgery on?
Mostly asymmetric bow ties that you could pretty much prove is not pellucid marginal degeneration. Also works really well in people who had surgery a long time ago and need an enhancement. You know, so if you have, you need to do more treatment to make a larger optic zone per treatment because they're getting glare. So you can use TCAT in order to treat those patients. Now the next kind of things, and this is more theoretical, no one's really trying this, but you know, potentially doing a pellucid patient or a mild keratoconus patient and then immediately doing corneal cross-linking. You know, so that's kind of the next holy grail, as it were, for those keratoconus patients that are getting more and more difficult to fit in contact lenses.
Do you know if they're doing that in Europe yet? Or I've kind of heard that theory tossed around a little bit, but they've done it on humans.
I don't know. I mean, honestly, if anything, there's a doctor out in California who is kind of like the refractive surgeon to the stars, that he pretty much does anything he wants. His name's Dr. Boxerwackler, and I don't know if he's doing it, but he'd probably be the first one in the U.S. to do it.
So maybe your keratoconus patient someday will be able to get LASIK, but we won't hold our breath for that for a while.
Right. I mean, you know, but it's really that the key to there is going to be when in-office cross-linking becomes more of a day-to-day kind of treatment for keratoconus. So
I'm just kind of circling back a little bit to some LASIK PRK basics, because as the docs on the other side of managing it, patients a lot of times will ask us, I feel like, way more questions about the procedure than they talk to their surgeon about, because then they've had like a couple of days to think about it. So how often do you, or like how long do you tell a patient who asks you, well, how many days do I need to take work, or how long is it going to be that I'm in pain? Like, what's the typical timeline for their healing these days?
Sure. With LASIK, I always, generally the pain after LASIK is only about 2 or 3 hours. Kind of feels like you have Tabasco sauce in your eyes. And usually you get some Ambien, you take a nap, and by the time you wake up, the pain is gone. Generally don't recommend people work the day after they have LASIK, even though in theory they're probably going to feel okay, they're going to see pretty well, but the people end up getting pretty dry by the end of that first day just because of the significant amount of inflammation that's there. So with LASIK, you take a day off, you know, 2 days, surgery day and then the next day. With PRK, it's longer. You're really going to be uncomfortable for about 24 hours. Then you kind of feel like you have a dry contact lens in your eye, that kind of feeling. But your vision's really not going to be very good for about 4 or 5 days after PRK. By about day 5, you can usually get down to about 20, 30, 40, enough to drive, but still not great. So usually I recommend about 4 or 5 days off of work after PRK.
So, you know, one question that I always get in the exam lane is, how much does it cost? Let's discuss pricing in regards to LASIK and PRK.
It's a variable. In general, it's some surgeons charge more for PRK because they have more follow-up. Some surgeons charge less for PRK because there's no royalty to pay to a flat maker. You know, there's only one laser instead of two lasers. In general, you're going to pay between $3,500 and $4,000. TCAT procedures, you're probably going to pay up to about $4,500.
And that's both eyes included?
Both eyes total, usually including post-operative care.
I've always gotten so, I just kind of tell my patients, kind of prepare for $3,500, because it's pretty common around the country too for you to see advertisements like $9.99 an eye. But it's there's going to be some more costs in there, pre-op, post-op management, stuff like that. They need to kind of budget appropriately so there's no surprises.
And usually the places that advertise the cheap LASIK, you're right, they don't include pre and post op care. They also are probably doing microkeratome LASIK.
Yeah, I mean, what are your thoughts on the Groupon deals that you see with LASIK or PRK? I mean, every time I see that, it just kind of raises a red flag to me.
I mean, I always, you know, granted, we don't know what's going to happen with healthcare in our country, but if you were going to have heart surgery, what would you do? Would you look in the phone book? Would you look for someone with a deal? Or would you ask your doctor to see who he or she recommends?
That's a great point and a good way to bring that to the attention of patients. I'm definitely going to start using that in the exam lane.
So, because think of it this way. You tell them you've seen patients from Dr. X. I don't care who it is. You know, I mean, you have an experience with a doctor. You know,
right.
I'll tell them, this is what I recommend. You can go to someone else. I don't know if they're going to be just as good as the guy I'm going to send you to. So it's kind of up to you at that point.
Let's talk a little bit about post-op management, because like Dr. Glover said, we do have a lot of students and new grad doctors listening on the podcast. So typically, you know, if you're not a referral center, you're seeing a LASIK or a PRK post-op about a week after the procedure. What should the patient look like and what should you be looking for?
Sure. I'll talk mostly about LASIK with this because really after you take a contact lens out for PRK, which takes place after, you know, bandage contact lens, they're pretty much the same. So I'll basically talk with LASIK starting at that 1 week visit. In general, the cornea looks very good at 1 week, especially with the newest iteration of the Intralase laser. Generally, what you'll notice is you'll notice starting to scar a little bit around the edge of the flap, so you'll get a little white, you know, kind of area there. Very, very faint. It'll look like a very faint chalk line. Really, what you're looking for is, at this point, you're looking at the interface behind the flap, between the flap and the treated area. That's the biggest thing to look for. You're looking for any kind of cells, any microstria, you know, that would cause bad vision. If the person's 20/20 or better and they have microstria, you don't worry about it. You know, I can't tell you how many people were sent back after their one that I saw when I was at the referral center at their 1 week visit. Doctor said they had stria, they needed a lift, and they were all prepared, and they come in and it's like, well, we're just going to watch it for a little while, and then 2 weeks later it's gone. Most things with LASIK, even dry eye, you can gauge by their vision. You know, don't overreact to things. If the patient's in pain or if their vision is blurry and it's uncorrectable, that requires a referral back to the referral center. However, that's pretty rare. I mean, generally, in all of the patients I've seen, even when I was at the referral center, we had to do one lift in about, you know, I don't know how, but in a 5-year period, he had to do one lift to replace a flap. And the person, it turns out, poked themselves in the eye with a dropper bottle. So you're kind of looking at that interface between the flap and the treated area. If it's otherwise clear and the edge looks good, the next thing you look for is staining. Need to use not fluoresce, but use, you know, some kind of fluorescein strip, let it dry out on the eye a little bit and look for any staining. If you see any staining, you have to treat them like they're the worst dry eye patient you've ever had. The worst dry eye patients after LASIK are the ones who did not have early enough intervention. If you see any staining, you bump up the steroid a little bit, see them back in a week. If it's not gone, you start them on, you know, Restasis or Xiidra or something like that until it goes away.
So you may or may not remember this. I'm going to tell an embarrassing story about myself. But as new grads, we don't see a lot of LASIK patients. If you think about where the schools are at, you're not really doing LASIK post-op care at optometry school. Mm-hmm. And usually on your rotations, most students will elect to go to a ocular disease rotation or something like that. And it's, again, not exactly healthy people that have done refractive surgery that you're seeing. And so I had a patient who had LASIK. It was like my very first post-op that I had seen. And there was some, you know, debris underneath the flap, but obviously it was very normal. But I was like, oh, maybe that shouldn't be there. I'm not sure. And so I referred them over to you. And you've been calling me like, it's totally normal. Everything's fine. But the reason I mentioned this story is if you feel like it's weird, have a doctor who's a mentor to you or that you're not embarrassed to reach out to, because there's no reason to really scare or worry the patient about it. And then, like, your advice is there. If the eye's quiet, if they're seeing 20/20, if there's nothing staining, a little, you know, debris or something like that, that's probably perfectly normal and fine. People can get a little pigment on their cornea and it's okay.
Indeed. And also pain. If the person's in discomfort, something's wrong, you know, at that visit. Doesn't mean something horrible is wrong. It's just something is going on. Really, at the 1 week visit, you know, you're looking at the flap and everything, but you're really looking for infection. Infections are exceptionally rare nowadays with LASIK. The prime time they start, though, is between days 3 and 10. You know, so it, you know, at that 5 to 7 day visit, that's when you're going to look for it. It will not look like debris. I've only seen it in pictures. I've never seen one specifically. But it will look like, you know, it'll be infiltrates, you know, true infiltrates, right. Not, you know, everyone knows the difference between debris and infiltrates. Debris looks foreign. It looks like plastic, you know, it glints. It doesn't look real. Even if you have a lash or a piece of acrylic, you know, under the flap, the body's going to eventually resorb it. It's going to be okay. So, yeah, but if the person's in pain and the cornea looks soupy and melty, then you get them back to the surgeon right away because that requires immediate treatment.
Dr. Meiner, how do you usually manage people who are experiencing some disappointment or dissatisfaction with their vision during the postoperative period.
It's much easier to do in the early going, you know, so when they're under 1 month, you can kind of say, and you don't lie, obviously, you just, you know, say everything's healing normally. Sometimes people just heal slowly. The biggest thing people will complain about is they'll say, I'm seeing glare and halos at night. If you tell them ahead of time, and usually when I was doing consultations, I will tell every patient, you're going to see glare and halos at night, and your vision's not going to be really sharp for probably almost 3 months. Okay. Now, generally, that's extended. Usually after a few days, it's fine. Me personally, I had LASIK. I had rainbows in my right, when I looked at light in my right eye for 4 months. Okay. There was nothing wrong with my cornea. Everything was totally clear. It's just one of those things where the microscopic holds between the two interfaces of the flap just weren't sealing down all the way. You just have to tell them that they're healing normally, but that they're just healing slowly. And generally, you can increase their artificial tears and everything like that. You're basically just trying to make them feel better. If you get to the 3 month period and they're still not seeing well, you're going to already see that there's some kind of refractive error there. You know, the quality of vision is generally going to be very good. There's nothing going to be inherent in the cornea that's going to make them not see well. If they're not seeing well at 1 month, 2 month, 3 months, they're probably going to be in line for an enhancement. But the easiest way to deal with that is be honest. You know, if you obfuscate and you try to just, you know, say, oh, well, you're doing okay, you know, all this, and you ignore their complaint, they're only going to fixate on it more. But you just have to frame it in realm of, this is normal healing. A significant amount of work was done on your cornea. It's just taking a little bit longer to heal than we anticipated.
So we've all kind of heard that 20 happy phrase. What do most surgeons these days kind of tell patients about what to expect from vision? Do they talk about 20/20, or is it really still one of those things where when a patient asks, what can I expect to see afterwards, like reading letters on a chart, you just kind of avoid guaranteeing 20/20?
You still avoid seeing 20/20, but if you talk to most surgeons, you know, the goal is to 20/20 or better, you know, one line or a visual acuity improvement or better. You know, I don't really hear much of the 20 happy anymore in the discussions. They really give raw numbers of, you know, with TCAT, 98% or 20/20 or better, 78% or 2016 or better, and 22% or 20/8 or better. I mean, they're using raw numbers. They're not just 20 happy. That's really the only way you have to measure. The key thing in when you're this can all be solved if you talk to the patient ahead of time before they have surgery. Okay. Just because they can see 20 whatever on the chart doesn't mean they're going to think their vision is clear. Their cornea isn't going to be inherently different, and it's very important that you prepare the patient for this. Hopefully the surgeon and or their person who does the consults is going to prepare them, but I always prepare patients and tell them there is a chance, it's a very small chance, I think the data is like 1 in 1200, that you will just physically not see as well, even best corrected after you have surgery. That doesn't mean you won't see 20/20, but you just physically might not see as clearly. And if they know that ahead of time and they don't want that to happen, then they shouldn't have had surgery to begin with. So I don't even involve the 20 happy into it, but I tell them that there is a very small chance that their quality of vision may not be as good as it was before. But this is all stuff that needs to be talked about before they have surgery.
Now, I know you mentioned Restasis earlier and Xiidra, but I'm curious to know, what's your experience with Xiidra so far?
So far, I haven't had to use it on any refractive surgery patients, so I don't have that data. I've prescribed it 10 or 11 times so far, seen and or talked to 7. All of them have reported improvement of their symptoms. 2 especially stick out are people that were having to get up in the middle of the night because their dry eye wakes them up in the middle of the night. And they say that, you know, after about 2 weeks, they don't have to do that anymore.
Wow.
So my experience with it has been positive. Now, whether their insurance continues to pay for it, that's a second, you know, that's another issue. But from a clinical point of view, it's, I haven't seen other, you know, everyone says it tastes bad. Everyone says it blurs their vision for a few minutes, but I always tell people that ahead of time. But I've had good success with it so far.
I've got one other pre-op kind of discussion topic for you. A contact lens wearer, how long should they be out of contacts before they get LASIK done?
So they should be out of their lenses for about 3 days before their consultation, if they're a soft lens wearer, whether it's toric or sphere. Before they have surgery, they need to be out of them 7 days if they're a sphere, 14 days if they're a toric wearer. If you're a gas perm wearer, you need to be out of them for 1 month per decade of wear. So if they've worn them for 30 years, they need to be out of them for 3 months. And then at those, they're going to have, you know, after that time, they're going to have corneal topographies every 2 weeks until you get two of the same topography before they go have surgery.
It's definitely something that I feel like, you know, patients come to sometimes take that as a shock. Even when I tell them, like, you're going to need to be out of your contact lenses for a week before the surgery, you'll have people like, oh my gosh, I just don't know if I can do that.
Well, you know, it's the kind of thing, if they can't do it, then you shouldn't send them for surgery, because, you know, because they're, you know, they're people who probably won't want to follow directions, you know, after the surgery, and they're going to turn into your nightmare. You know, the people that you see every 2 days because they didn't take their drops or whatever, you know? So yeah, I mean, if they're not willing to live up to what they have to do, just go, yeah, sorry, it's just not for you. Then we'll stick with contact lenses. Because the way I frame it is, you know, I tell them that the surgery causes a lot of inflammation. Even normal, healthy contact lens wear creates a small amount of swelling and inflammation. So imagine you don't want to have your surgery when your cornea is compromised in any way. So, you know, a lot of times when you tell them that, it just kind of clicks in to go, oh yeah, I'm doing this for the rest of my life, or I can be out of my contact lenses for 2 weeks.
So what kind of advice do you have for the 40 plus club? Because we always get those patients coming in wanting to discuss refractive surgery.
It depends on how bad they are. You know, it's you know, if they're a minus 7 myope, they're probably not going to care if they have to wear reading glasses afterwards. But the minus 1 to minus 2, the conversation you have to have. You just have to let them know. If they're a contact lens wearer, they kind of know what to expect, you know? If they're not a contact lens wearer, if it's possible, definitely doesn't hurt to throw a pair of contact lenses on their eyes in the exam room just to kind of show them, this is what it's going to be like up close. Is that okay? Can you live with that? The treatments for presbyopia right now in the refractive surgery front are just not here. You know, I mean, it's when you boil down to it, there's so much technology that we can discuss here. But what it all boils down to is it's mostly monovision at this point, you know. If they're 40 to 50, basically people can tolerate about 1.5 diopters of monovision. So if they're a contact lens patient, you try it. You figure out which eye is dominant. I like to use fog as opposed to, you know, the little triangle on the hands kind of thing. I think that's a little bit more accurate when it comes to how they're going to react after surgery, you know, and then you give them the contact lens and have them wear it for a couple of days. And hey, if they didn't adapt, then you're sure as heck not going to be able to adapt after LASIK. But it is probably the number one reason why people are disappointed after LASIK is you could tell them 100 times, you are going to need reading glasses after LASIK. You are going to need reading glasses after LASIK. And they come back for their 1 week post-op. Man, you know, I really can't see up close anymore. And you're like, yeah, remember all that stuff we talked about? So it's
like I said it 3 times to you.
Yeah. If not 100 times, you know, and then the surgeon said it to them and everything. It's, they know it intellectually, but they just don't know it, you know, viscerally, that how much, you know, their reading vision is going to change afterwards. You know, but you know, you get those people that have really high nearsighted, or if they have 3 diopters of SIL, they don't care. They just don't want to have to buy expensive glasses. They don't care if they're just, you know, buying some, you know, some simple progressives, or, you know, like I had surgery 10 years ago and I'm in my mid 40s now. I wear, you know, like the Shamir workspace lens at work. You know, that's fine, but I'm at work. I don't really wear them at all unless I'm, you know, like I'm on my computer now and looking at my notes and things. I'm not wearing them because they're all far enough away, you know, and I wouldn't have, but I was a -4, -250 SIL patient before I had LASIK. It depends on the person. You know, the low myopes are a harder sell, and anyone you're doing it, you got to do a contact lens trial on them of any kind of monovision, because it's going to get brought up in the surgery center.
Do you have any kind of dialogue with patients in regards to blue light? Because once they have that procedure done, and you know, if they don't need the glasses for near vision, what do you tell them at that point? I mean, because, you know, we're always constantly educating about blue light, anti-reflective coating, transition lenses. I mean, what do you do about that?
Well, you still tell them that, like the Relax lens that has the blue block coating, you know, on it, more than likely they're not going to need that changed for a very long time. You know, so you can still have that conversation and talk to them about the protection, and then, you know, improving sleep quality and everything. You're also going to want to tell them a lot about blinking exercises as well, just so they don't get dry after they've spent all this money on LASIK. But you can still have that conversation. It's just, you know, you're not saying it as more, you know, this is going to help you see better. It's like, it's just going to be healthier for your eyes overall.
Daryl, I've also, I don't know if you guys have ever talked to your patients about this, but let's say you have just tonally plano, wonderful, happy vision, but they do have some of those kind of classic digital eye strain complaints, but you're trialing plus and it's just like, that's not helping. So a relaxed lens isn't really going to do a whole lot. I will talk to them about that Flux, that free download to try to reduce the blue light straight from their screen, and then the blinking exercises. And I think those two things in combo can really help with some of their sensitivity if you're just not finding low plus beneficial.
And you know, on the iPhones now or any Apple product, I believe they have that deal where before you go to bed, you can just turn off kind of like the blue light and it relaxes the eyes even more as well.
Yeah, and then in individual apps, you're starting to get dark mode. You know, so, you know, I advise patients to flip things over to dark mode when they have the opportunity. I know I like to read before bed, and my news reader that I like to read from, I just click a little thing under the font menu and boom, it all turns basically black with white text. So, but much less strain on the eyes.
So now you mentioned earlier that presbyopic surgeries just really aren't there yet. You've probably had a couple of patients do this to you too, but there was this little segment on the Today Show where they showed this woman going in and she had I think it was a camera inlay done, and she can just see up close and it's a miracle. And they didn't really talk about all the issues involved with it. So I've had quite a few people come in and ask me about this, but what is kind of the consensus out there about the camera inlay and the new raindrop inlay?
So the camera inlay and the raindrop inlay work in two relatively different ways. You know, the camera inlay is kind of like a pinhole effect, but it also causes a slight steepening of the cornea in the center. The basic, according to the data, is it's about 75% to 80% effective. You know, so most surgeons, I think there are a lot of surgeons that will do it, but you can tell patients there is a 25% chance that this isn't going to work. You know, that they're going to have to take it out. And if you're familiar with the camera lens, it has a bunch of little tiny pinholes in it that allows for kind of nutrients to get through it, basically, because it's relatively thick. What they're finding out in some patients is that those little holes can get clogged, and then it creates apoptosis, you know, programmed cell death behind the camera. So that if you then take it out, there's a ring scar there that will never go away. Yeah. So then that patient is stuck with glare for the rest of their life. Given the risk of that, plus the fact that there's a 25% failure rate with them, I wouldn't recommend it. I mean, yeah, it's possible. And if they're not very risk averse and they're just like, anything to get rid of these stupid reading glasses, kind of buyer beware, in my opinion. The raindrop is basically most akin to, I guess, what you'd call a near-centered bifocal contact lens, okay? So it's a very small, it's like an 80% water, looks like a tiny contact lens, and it's inserted in the cornea, much the similar way that a camera lens is. What it does is it makes the middle part of the cornea prolate. So it makes you a little bit nearsighted in the center, and it gradually, you know, flattens out to your normal, you know, your normal prescription, so that you get kind of a modified monovision effect. The results of that are very good. But again, there isn't as much negative downside to the raindrop. But again, it's only about an 80% success rate. You know, the surgeon that I talked to, you know, about this, he says, I don't want to sell my patients 80%. I want to sell them 99%. You know, so, and that's what I think too. I'm not going to send a patient that there's a pretty significant chance that it's just not going to work. You know, so the next iteration of this corneal inlay technology is the presbyo lens, which is much more akin to the distance bioaffinity multifocal. It doesn't change the shape of the cornea. It's a physical powered lens. It basically gives, gosh, I can't remember exactly, but it's somewhere between 1.8 and 2.1 diopters of reading power, but it has a tiny hole in the middle of it that allows for distance vision. You know, so the whole thing's about 2.5 to 3 millimeters wide, but there's a little tiny hole in the middle that allows for distance. So trials which were completed, I think last year, 18 months ago, the data is kind of unofficial, but it's basically greater than 98% happy rating for reading. Yeah, 2% had to have it removed, and there's no you know, so far the only complication they're seeing is one patient had a little bit of haze develop, but it didn't affect vision at all.
So with co-managing with something like this, is it pretty lucrative?
Generally, yeah. I mean, depending on the surgeon you work with, you know, there are obviously laws against how much they generally, you know, pay you a percentage of what it is. I can't remember the name of the law that it's just escaping me right now. But, you know, generally for LASIK, you're going to probably get between $550 and $625 for your basically three post-op visits. For PRK, you're going to get paid usually between $650 and $700, depending on the surgeon, for relatively minimal work. I mean, you know, the vast, you know, everyone will have that one nightmare patient that they had to see 40 times in a year, but that's very few and far between.
Yeah, I'll take it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they still have refractive needs, you know.
Right.
About, you know, there's still going to be computer vision syndrome. There's still going to be, you know, and all that. So it's, I don't buy the, you know, I don't send patients out because it's going to lose me, you know, it's going to lose me that patient in the long run. No, that patient's going to love you because you helped them.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you helped guide them in the direction of not needing glasses anymore. It, if anything, it drives more patient care than loses patients. So,
would you mind talking to us a little bit? Because there might be doctors listening that are kind of curious or thinking they may want to work at a LASIK referral center. I mean, do you have any advice on what that kind of career is like and any pros or cons from your experience?
Sure. I think it's the only way to really get into it. I mean, it's hard to say how to get into it. It's, you know, you apply and you basically, you don't need to basically know everything there is about refractive surgery to work in a refractive surgery center. My colleague who works in the Greensboro TLC location, who is their clinical director, he worked for 2 years in primary care, and he's been working at that center for, you know, he's a year older than I am, you know, for almost 20 years, he's been doing refractive surgery type things. You know, like I said, I worked in it for about 5 years. It does get a little monotonous because it's the same, you know, you don't fit contact lenses. You don't treat disease that's not dry eye. You know, you don't treat glaucoma. You do retinal exams, but you know, you see anything, boom, they're off to the retina doctor, you know, because that's not what you're doing. You know, so I don't really know how to describe what kind of personality you would need to do that, you know, if you wanted to do that full time. It's very rewarding. I mean, the you know, just seeing people the day after who are crying because they haven't been able to see without glasses since they were a little child, and just, you know, gushing. It's, you know, it gets you in a good way. You know, it's very, very satisfying from a clinical point of view, but it can get a little monotonous. So you have to really, you know, if you want to moonlight on the, you know, on the day, your days off or something like that to kind of get the primary care bug, I guess it kind of depends on your personality more than anything else, but I don't think it's necessarily, it's definitely not a quote unquote difficult job, and you learn something that you otherwise really wouldn't learn. I mean, if I was just always in primary care, I wouldn't know a quarter of this stuff that I know now.
Yeah, I think it's pretty cool. I mean, we've been talking to a lot of students lately, and one thing that we keep hearing about are specialties. A lot of students are starting to look for specialties to have outside of just the primary care. And I think this fits right into, you know, with dry eye or glaucoma. I think this is a good addition that they can add to their portfolio.
Yeah, absolutely. Just being knowledgeable to talk to patients about this kind of stuff. Younger patients are going to flock to a doctor who's a little bit more proactive on new surgical techniques and referring and talking to them about it. So even if obviously you're not out of practice that's doing LASIK, just having new young blood in there as an associate doctor who's going to develop a co-management referral source with you with the local ophthalmologist can be really beneficial and lucrative to your practice.
And there are a lot of people who end up at the refractive surgeon unreferred, who, if you have a good relationship with a doctor, you know, there are a lot of people going, yeah, I want to have surgery, and they have keratoconus. Well, that patient's going to need a contact lens fit. And if that refractive surgeon knows that you do that kind of thing,
very good point.
It can go, you know, the referrals definitely go both ways.
So Dr. Marino, what's next? I mean, what is Dr. Stonecipher or other doctors you're talking to in the industry really looking forward to as the next big thing in refractive surgery?
Really, the next big thing is nailing down presbyopia. I mean, that's really it. You know, you had mentioned that we talked about the smile technique, which is basically using a femtosecond laser to kind of reshape within the cornea. You know, so you're leaving the surface alone, and you know, and you're just kind of leaving a very small incision to remove the excess tissue that's, you know, that's left over. Their work is very early, but again, they're kind of at that 75 to 80% are plus or minus one, you know, and again, you're not going to be able to sell 80%, you know, to someone, you know, you're not going to do this. The main reason for that is a femtosecond laser just simply doesn't create as fine of a cut as a LASIK laser does. You know, the femtosecond laser is great at creating the flap, but it's just not smooth enough. And that's why the vision just isn't perfect for that. But again, it's early, it's new. Going back to the, you know, presbyopia treatments, there are a few different, you know, we talked about the inlays, the implantable lenses that are there for refractive lens exchange. They're working on eye drops. Most of the eye drops that are used are all about repositioning the lens. There's basically a offshoots of brimonidine or pilocarpine that are basically stimulating accommodation or simply shifting the lens forward a little bit to allow for a little bit more near vision. But the one that's, you know, kind of in testing now is this one called EV06. That's a prodrug that actually gets into, you know, through the anterior chamber into the lens and actually makes the lens, it helps it regain its elasticity so you can physically focus better. The results of that after 90 days, distance adjusted near vision after 90 days, 22% were 20/40, 24% were 20/32, 24% were 20/25, and 12% were 20/20. So, you know, that these were patients that were between the ages of 45 and 60 that they did this on. So that's something that hopefully, especially from our realm, that'd be something that we can prescribe for people that, you know, that's not a referral. That's, hey, you don't want to wear glasses? Buy this out of our office. Or, you know, I don't know how it will be, if it'll be something you sell through your office or something you would just write a prescription for. But that's exciting. That's something that optometry can do, you know, to physically affect someone's vision in a non-surgical way. But it's really all about presbyopia at this point.
Have you seen that study out where they're talking about electrostimulation may delay the early stages of presbyopia?
No, I haven't.
This it's pretty really cool. Recent. I think, wasn't it a contact lens, Daryl? And they wear this lens and they apply like a little bit of an electric shock, basically. And
You got it.
So it stimulates the muscle or something like that?
Every couple months. So they have to keep coming back into the office.
Yeah.
It's interesting. Yeah, that's pretty interesting. So yeah, no, I haven't heard about that. I'm going to have to look at that. I'm going to look that up. I'd probably much rather probably prescribe a drop than do electroshock therapy in someone's eyes.
There is something a little scary about, like, I'm just picturing us, like, hooking patients up, and it's like Frankenstein.
I mean,
like,
lip flow already looks weird enough, let alone, something that will deliver an electric charge to the eye.
It add a little excitement to the day.
Yeah, exactly. You got to make, you know, just have someone come in and have the lights dim whenever it happens, you know, have some effect or whatever.
Definitely check it out. I think they're doing it over in Europe, just like everything else, but it seems pretty cool.
Well, thank you so very much for your time today, Dr. Marino. I always learned so much talking to you about this different side of optometry, where we sometimes kind of think of it as the other side, the part where we don't do, we just refer that out. But so much of what's successful in refractive surgery is because we help guide the patients to the right surgery choice. So I appreciate your insights on everything.
Oh, it was great. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Okay, it's a wrap. Thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to hang out with Defocus Media. We hope something resonated with you today. Please subscribe to our podcast and remember, we keep it 2020 around here, pun intended. We look forward to seeing you next time.